Welcome to another Precure Prescription for Life podcast. We're here exploring health, life, and everything in between. We are joined here today by Dr. Louise Schofield and Professor Grant Schofield to talk about the 7 rules for sustained behavioural change.
Hi Louise, we're talking about the 7 rules of behaviour change.
We sure are. This is really the heart or the guts of behaviour change. How do you do it? And I think as a health coach, at some point it actually gets pretty tough with your clients. And why does it get tough? It gets tough because behaviour change is hard and it's messy. And sometimes your clients' lives or your lives are actually a little bit chaotic. And it's not easy. To change behaviour, it takes time and it takes repetition. So I've put together 7 rules to really help guide you as a health coach to navigate through that chaos, that muckiness.
So what do rules mean? Is it stuck in stone? You have to do these? What does that mean?
Look, I think I have actually used the term rules rather than guidelines because I think as humans, we actually need rules to help us make sense of a chaotic world. And I think there is a bit of a misnomer, or there is this funny thing we like to tell ourselves that actually we're just free-spirited and we'll go with the flow. And you know what? That's actually BS when it comes to behaviour change. And why is it BS? It's because it's hard. If behaviour change was easy, we wouldn't have all the chronic disease, we wouldn't have all the issues that we have. What we know is that the brain craves routine. The brain craves putting anything, any behaviour into a habit. And so to break that habit is really hard to do. So we need rules to help us. These are based on experience over the last decade of what actually works in with real people in real messy, mucky lives.
Craig, I love it. Let's get into the rules and explore them one at a time. So rule one, know your why.
Know your why. This one is so fundamental to behaviour change that, in fact, we've done an entire lesson on it. It really is, you know, the heart of this one is don't bother going any further if you can't articulate or your client can't articulate the true driver behind why they want to change that behaviour. Because, Grant, I want to tell you a secret. As a health coach, you can't change your client's behaviour. You cannot, even with these rules, you as a health coach can't change their behaviour.
It's up to them, right?
Of course it is. Of course it is. And that is actually the secret.
They must change
their own behaviour.
And is your point there that the first thing that comes out of their mouth may not be the why, the actual why?
It is probably most likely not to be. As we talked about in the last lesson, you ask why 5 times. Maybe it's 3 or maybe it's 7. But pretty rarely do we have enough self-awareness that we get to the true why on the first time. So your job as a health coach is to help people understand their true driver, their true call to action.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, right? Because that's the real job of a health coach. You're helping someone out along their way. This is really helping them delve down enough to actually understand what's going on underneath the hood.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right, rule 2 is a fun rule.
It sure is. Make it fun. Now, this one is easy to dismiss as sort of going, really, that's not that important. But I think of this rule, really, make it fun. It's applied positive psychology in terms of, look, at the very least, making something fun will at least spur people's curiosity to try something different. This past weekend, for example, my 8-year-old Danny and I spent the weekend having the most fun on these new Lime scooters. Now, we were laughing, and they go about 25 kilometres an hour.
Quite fast.
But they're just fun, and you get on there, and it's joyful. You feel like you're a kid again. And I had to think, maybe we've struggled for years really to try and decrease our dependency on the car. And there's been buses and we've got trains and we've got cycle lanes and all of this type of thing. But I actually wonder, because these scooters, these automated scooters are so fun. It might be the thing that actually spurs people to change their behaviour. It spurs a curiosity to get out of the car and try it.
Could I put it in a scientific behavioural sense? So there's this idea that if something good happens to you when you do something, then you're more likely to do it again. If something benign, neutral, or negative happens when you're doing something, you're less likely to do it again. What do you make of that? Is that having fun? Fun means that you're more likely to do that behaviour again.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really important point, because when we talk about fun, it's not what you as the health coach thinks is fun. It's understanding, immersing yourself in your clients' lives to understand what is fun to them. In fact, we call this, from an innovation point of view, design thinking. Be an innovator, be a designer in your clients' lives, and get in there and understand what is fun to them. For some people, having fun is competition. It's doing an Ironman. It's running a marathon. For other people, that's not fun at all. So I think it's really getting in and understanding what is fun for your clients, where is the joy in their life, and how can you help them to design solutions based on that fun. So look, it's not, of all the rules, it's maybe not the biggest one. But
oh, I like it. I think it's behavioural psychology in disguise, and pretty much describes life.
Yeah, it absolutely is, actually. You know, as I said, I call it fun's applied positive psychology. So, yeah, I suppose actually don't underestimate it.
Rule 3, make it as positive as you can. How's that different from the fun rule?
So I think as health coaches, we need to be very aware of the language that we're using. It's very powerful. So this rule is just making sure that the language you're using is as positive as possible. As a beginning health coach, one of the mistakes we quite often see is that it's very easy to focus on all the things wrong with your client. They're overweight. They don't eat properly. They don't exercise enough. And I think if you can learn to talk to your clients in a way that builds their confidence, it builds their efficacy, then that's actually the key to behaviour change.
Right, so if they weren't exercising at all, they tell you they want to do 8 sessions a week, but they come back and they've done 1. That's good, right?
Wow, absolutely. That's certainly better than 0.
Yeah, concentrate on the positives.
Absolutely, concentrate on the positives. Look, an interesting example, I think, a little bit morbid, but is consider the language between it's end of life, you're in the hospital, it's a loved one, and there is a sign that you get asked can be put behind the bed, and that is DNR, and that means do not resuscitate. Now, just imagine yourself as a loved one standing next to your partner, and you get asked, would you like us to put a DNR order? And that's it's a hard decision to make. It's phrased in the negative, do not resuscitate. It feels like you are making a decision to kill your partner, which of course you're not. What if we changed that language around? What if we accentuated the positive, and instead of DNR, we said allow for a natural death? Now, the actual action that happens, regardless of whether it's DNR or allow for a natural death, is the same. The person will not be resuscitated if they go into cardiac arrest. But just consider the feelings and the emotions of the partner and the family. It's a lot more positive and a lot easier on them to allow for a natural death.
Great. Love it. Well, I don't love that exactly, but I hear you. That's a really powerful change in language.
It is. Look, so, I think another one in terms of accentuate the positive is the concept of fear. Now, I think fear is not always the greatest driver of behaviour change, but let me put a caveat on that to say that actually it can't be completely discounted. If you have just received a diagnosis of cancer, if you have just had a heart attack, well, in fact, we call those quite teachable moments. And of course, you are fearful for your life and you're quite motivated to change. But apart from those situations, and most of the time, fear, in fact, is not that great a motivator.
So that's sort of the behavioural psychology work that shows that fear in animals and humans definitely stops you doing what you're doing. It doesn't necessarily allow you to start what you're doing. So fear will stop bad behaviours, but it doesn't allow new ones to develop. So I think you're right around that.
That's a great, actually, that's a great way of putting it. And what we know that does allow us to start new behaviour is a belief and an efficacy that we can do it, that we've got this, that we are good enough to make a change and make it last. So that's actually, when we study people who have been able to make successful behaviour changes, you can often see right back at the start that they will say, yes, I think, I believe I can do this. They've got the self-belief.
Okay, rule four, a bit confused about this one, sounds a bit funny. Make it easy. I thought this stuff was hard.
Yeah, look, it's as making behaviour change, to me, this is the big rule. Make the healthy choice the easy choice. So what do we mean in practice by that? Let's talk about willpower and won't power to start with. In terms of willpower is, I will eat healthy today. But I tell you what, it's much easier to eat healthy if there's not a packet of chocolate biscuits in your fridge. Because this afternoon at 4 o'clock when you're tired and your energy's down and you've had a hard day and you open the fridge and there's a packet of, I won't eat those, is actually quite hard. What would have been much easier is if those chocolate biscuits were never in the fridge in the first place. So that's what we mean when we say make it as easy as possible.
So you're talking about environmental changes to support your behaviour rather than just relying on your own toughness of spirit, so to speak.
Exactly. Look, willpower is vastly overrated. We look at people and we think, oh, they've got such good willpower. Well, not really. It's probably much more likely that they've actually just got themselves into some good routines and habits. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. But someone who really understood that willpower and cognitive capacity is limited on a daily basis was actually Steve Jobs. So as you might may be aware, Steve famously wore essentially the same pair of Levi jeans, sneakers, and a black turtleneck sweater, no matter what the occasion. And the reason he did that is because he understood that making a decision on a daily basis about what to wear had some, you know, was taxing on his cognitive capacity. So he set up rules for himself around things like that that to him didn't really matter. And that left him with more capacity to do the brilliant invention of all of the tech tools that he did. But I think, how do we apply that, what I like to think of as the Steve Jobs rule, into behaviour change? And that's essentially just understanding that set yourself rules to make it easier. Have rules around food. Have rules around drinking alcohol. Have rules around going to bed. Have rules around exercising.
Is that chicken salad thing? I actually copied you recently, Alice. I found it quite good. Was that when we go out for lunch, and instead of making another difficult decision about the food, it's just like, I'll just have the chicken salad. Thanks. I actually like chicken salads. They generally come out quite good. I want to keep reasonably low carb, so that's the case. And actually, it's been quite good. Really enjoyed that.
Absolutely. I think if you actually had to write down the number of times in a day where you have to make a decision around food, you would be blown away.
I think someone's done that. I think it's 350 or something is a number that I recall.
It's not 5 or 6 or 7 decisions you make about food every day. It is literally hundreds. And that is fine when you wake up in the morning and you've had a good night's sleep and you're feeling particularly motivated for a few hours. But where you come off the rails is the moment you have something stressful happening or something goes wrong. Then it becomes hard. So that's what this rule is all about. Make it easy. And having rules, having go-to meals. When I'm out for lunch, I'll order a chicken salad. When I'm out for breakfast, or what I eat for breakfast is scrambled eggs. Having rules around the simple behaviours makes it a lot easier.
Okay, so diligence, not effort. Put your effort in the right place because your mind's a muscle and it'll run out of capacity at some point in the day, all right?
Absolutely.
All right, rule five is about making it a habit.
Yeah, and actually, so this one flows really nicely from making it easy because, of course, having rules allows us to turn things into routine. So routine is necessary in the acts of life that we repeat every day, and that allows things to be stable and reliable, and that's like our eating, our exercising behavior. So to understand this, just for a moment, think about young children. Our youngest now is 8, but you know, back when they were 3, 4 and preschoolers, they're absolutely delightful when they're in a routine, they've had their same sleep, their eating patterns are the same. They're very quickly not delightful when they're out of routine, when they haven't had the food they're used to, when they haven't had the night's sleep. And why is that? It is because the brain is always looking for ways to save effort and to be into a routine. We like a routine.
So we like to automate. We like to make shortcuts. And if you've got poor health behaviours, it'll automate that. And if you've got good health behaviours, it'll automate that. So it's going to automate. Just depends on what you want to automate. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. I think we don't actually always get to choose our habits.
Well, the brain will choose them.
Exactly. That's the point. The brain will choose them, but they will not necessarily be good habits. They will, yeah.
Exactly.
Great.
Love it. A couple more to go here. Rule 6, involve other people. People rule.
It certainly is. Our brains are deeply social. So as humans, it was crucially important to us as we lived, mated and evolved to be able to get on very well with other people. In fact, I think a few years ago now, there's quite a famous psychologist, Chris Peterson, who summed up the last 10 years of research in psychology in 3 words. And those 3 words were other people matter. And so other people matter to us in terms of our well-being. But they particularly matter to us when we're trying to change behaviour or to become more healthy. Research examining social relationships shows us that there's a strong and consistent link between being married and having better physical health. Why is that? Because you can support each other. There's so many times when after work I would be reaching for a glass of wine, you come in the door and say, let's go for a walk. Positive. Of course, you can have negative effects, but other people do really matter. And the influence of our peers and friends, the people we surround ourselves with, are really important. They will either amplify or hinder our efforts to achieve well-being.
And if you tell them, they'll probably help. It's like, don't do this in secret.
Absolutely. So, yeah, when you're working with yourself or with your clients, get them to bring as many people along with them as possible. Think back to my PhD research. It was actually on adolescent girls and physical activity and how do you change their behaviour to become more physically active as 15 and 16-year-old girls. And one thing that we clearly found was the girls who were consistently active were, of course, their friends were also very active. So there's a good neural network.
That's right.
So choose your friends well.
So what do you make of the more biological evolutionary theory that humans are actually special animals because, and perhaps because we had to actually hunt animals together in small groups, that we had to have some hardwired characteristics. And those two characteristics are that we have mirror neurons, so we have a built-in empathy, if you like, so that someone you're close to is happy, you're happy. If they're in need, you're in need. That's the first thing. And the second thing, we have this built-in altruism that we will give away some of our resources to other people close to us, even if it's at our own detriment, as long as it benefits the group as a whole. And there's only one other animal that shares those characteristics, which is interesting. Do you know what that animal is?
Oh, I want to say a dog.
But yes, you're right. Of course it is. It's dogs. They've got mirror neurons just like us. So you pet your dog. The dog's lighting up, you're lighting up, it's all go. So that's interesting, isn't it?
So actually, that's exactly what I was saying. Our brains are deeply social.
Hardwired for it. This is not something you can overcome. Last rule, track and measure.
Look, when you give people specific information about their own health, it works. It works if you have general information, oh, look, the heart disease statistics are this percentage or whatever, that's not so much. When you can say your risk in the next 5 years and be very specific, and you're talking about information specific to that person, there is a real emotional connection with that information because it's ours. An example of that is when you're driving along and there's those your speed signs. So literally, it's an electronic
sign. Oh, yeah, the thing clocks your vehicle and all of a sudden you're speeding.
And but you know what? What they've actually found is that reduces speed by up to 10%, and the effect actually lasts for a number of kilometres later. It's much more powerful than just a generic sign saying the speed limit's 100 kilometres or 50 kilometres. It literally gives me specific information about the speed that I'm doing right now, and that actually changes my behaviour. So data is important, and measuring and tracking progress is really, really important.
Is that why I've got this, I'm into this smartwatch type things. It's not everyone's idea of fun, so probably not yours, but for me what it does is that it records my exercise and sleep and what I do, and I can see that that's real data, so that which fits into Rule 7. But not only that, is it gets shared across Strava, which is a social networking thing with my friends about the exercise and stuff they're doing, and we give each other kudos, that's the term called in Strava, and
sure,
the thumbs up, and we comment on each other's stuff, and it's all very positive. Is that sort of a behavioural thing for me, some of these rules?
Well, I think that's more than just Rule 7, the track and measure. I mean, obviously that has a bit of fun, that has involving other people. It's probably the guys at Strava and the girls are pretty smart in terms of what they've been able to do. So I think tracking and measuring progress is, what we know is that success breeds success.
Yeah.
So celebrate small wins with your clients. And that allows them to become more emboldened and strengthened to increase their efficacy. And remember, that's your job as a health coach, is to build confidence.
Yeah, so you're not trying to be the drill sergeant here and ball it out of them that they need to do this and do that, because that's just not going to work. And I think we've covered that. Yeah, I think we've covered that in a range of things in this course.
Yeah, absolutely. Learning how to talk to people and building their efficacy, that's the key to sustainable behaviour change.